Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of writers and artists over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life and the industry, politics, composition, whatever. If you ask me, songwriters are some of the most worldly and intelligent people I've ever come across. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. Now, I'm co-producing this with my friend Joe London, who was nominated for a Grammy earlier this year for Best Country Song. He makes us sound like angels. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, go to Spotify and look up our playlist, And the Writer Is, or go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate that effort.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm recording this week's intro from my phone because I'm at a writing camp in New York City. I probably could have found a studio, but most of my career is sending ideas back and forth using voice notes. So this is the most authentic songwriter experience I can give you. This week's guest is Luke Laird. We recorded this episode only a few weeks ago, and he has since notched his 23rd number one country song with Fast by Luke Bryan. His 23rd. If you know country, you know Luke Laird. If you don't, you will after this episode. But most importantly, other than being one of the best writers in country music history, he's a good dad and a good husband. One note about something we discussed in this podcast. We talk about MDRCs, which means minimum delivered release commitment. Essentially, when you sign a publishing deal that has an MDRC of 2 songs, you need your percentage of major label releases to equal 200% of a song. So, if you're writing with 5 people, you'd need 10 songs released to equal 200%. Doesn't matter if it's a hit, it just matters that the song gets released. I guarantee we discuss this more in future episodes. Anyway, I'm so excited for you to hear Luke's story of being raised on an actual dirt road to where he is now. So without further ado, here is And the Writer Is. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's Grammy-winning writer-producer has 22 number one country records. He's a perennial nominee for Songwriter of the Year at the ACMs and won it in 2015. He's won the Triple Play Award at CMAs a bunch of times and received BMI's Songwriter of the Year in 2012. When he's not smashing country records, he's releasing, writing, and recording songs with Ne-Yo, Snoop Dogg, and Charlie Puth. This Nashville entrepreneur founded one of the best publishing companies on Music Row and was my introduction to country co-writes. And the writer is the music industry's number one professional wrestling fan, Luke Laird.
Yo, yo.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's go to the club, baby.
I can't really read, so that was...
No, it was good, man.
I got through most of it. Can edit it in post. So, yeah, when did you get into professional wrestling?
I got into professional wrestling a long time ago, probably about 1986, when I was in, first grade.
And did you have every action figure? I don't think people realize how much you like it unless they know you, but
yeah.
Your fanaticism is...
I grew up in Pennsylvania, so the wrestling that I watched was pretty much right when WWF got huge and Vince McMahon, started WrestleMania. That was Hulk Hogan,
Yeah.
And so I was part of the big commercial wrestling boom.
And were you going to actual... wrestling match, or were you just watching Friday Night Raw or whatever it's called?
Well, it was before Monday Night Raw. Every Saturday. This is how big wrestling became at that time. Every Saturday, or one Saturday a month on NBC, in the time slot where Saturday Night Live was, they would have Saturday Night's main event. So literally, Saturday Night Live was only 3 times a month, and once a month was Saturday Night's main event. That's how big it was. So, yeah, every birthday, every Christmas, I asked for tickets to, you know, go see Macho Man Randy Savage or Hulk Hogan.
Oh, yeah, man. Did you get to meet Macho Man at all before?
I didn't.
Did you meet any of them? Have you ever met
Hulk Hogan? Yeah, got to hang out with him.
Did you get to write with him?
I didn't write with him, but there was a lot of inspiration there. So,
were you starstruck?
A little bit, yeah.
Like, I don't get starstruck that much outside of, you know, or in the music industry, but it's always someone like, oh, man, that's...
You're almost like when you do the jobs that we have, you're just kind of required to, like, play it cool around big artists and stuff like that. But when it comes to athletes or professional wrestlers...
My first license is writing The Miz's theme song. Do you know The Miz? He's a WWE champion now.
His
wife and he are like have a show, and he's like a huge wrestler now. And we were hanging around Hollywood, and it was one of those things where he was like, he was on Real World,
yeah.
And when Real World people stop working on Real World, they move to LA. And then after that,
they moved to Nashville.
And after that, they moved to Nashville, right. But we ended up, he was just like, I'm starting to do some professional wrestling. Do you want to write my theme song?
No way.
So my first, like, license was when they were, like, he kept doing these road rules, real world challenges. And they would always play the Miz theme song. Which was like my first license. I was just writing it while I was in a band, and I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna write your theme." So I kept going to all these professional wrestling events.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, I'll get you tickets. I know people.
You know, not that he would be listening, but if Vince McMahon is listening, I'd love to have that opportunity. I'll give you
to write a theme song.
Yeah,
doesn't matter who it is.
Doesn't matter. I don't even need any money.
I don't know if you want to keep that part.
I would do one of the. I'm not joking.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I will. I'm gonna pass this along.
We've probably lost our audience at this point.
Right. Exactly. So wait, when you're in Pennsylvania and you're watching wrestling, mm-hmm. what's your music education like?
You know, my music
was
music
it the WWE. You had the WWE.
Oh,
like,
I've got
all those albums.
Yeah, the first album. The second album was called Pile Driver.
Was that stuff like influencing you at that point?
Musically,
were you
entrance theme songs, I guess, you know, maybe a little bit. But honestly, my influences at that time were just what was on popular radio.
Yeah, you weren't listening to country
Michael Jackson
in particular or anything?
Not at that age. I mean, I guess a little bit because my parents listened to it, but... But
were they musicians?
No, they just played the radio.
Uh-huh.
And... I mean, I know for sure my two big musical influences early on in my life. The first tape I ever had was Michael Jackson Thriller.
Sick.
So you've got that, and then the first like album I remember hearing that my parents had and played it around the house was the Willie Nelson record. I can't remember the title of it now, where he covered like old pop standards. I didn't realize that at the time. I just thought it was country music, but Stardust, that was the record.
Uh-huh.
So if you listen to both those records, they're so different. But when I think back on that now, how much both of those types of music have influenced what I do today.
Oh,
it's pretty amazing.
And are you listening to this? So then for radio stations, are you listening to
just the
pop radio?
Just the current pop music until I got, you know, to junior high and really got into country music.
That's when you were in junior, who introduced you to country music?
Was
that big in where you grew up?
Yes, I grew up in rural America, northwestern Pennsylvania, outside of a little town called Conneaut Lake. I grew up on a dirt road with my last name, Laird Road. I grew up on Laird Road.
Was it your grandpa?
Yeah, well, I think it was even before him, but yeah, I grew up right next to my grandparents' farm, and
How many generations back do you have to go to get a road named after you?
I don't know. I know the farm was in the late 1800s is when that was kind of started there. But, and so I think that country music, that's, once I was old enough to actually, when you care about lyrics or listen to them, I kind of, first of all, I thought they were written really well lyrically, but I could relate.
Right. Well, that was, I was talking to Brandi Clark, where she was saying that she goes, so much of this music's just not authentic because none of them have grown up on a dirt road.
Right.
You know, and then yeah. You actually were brought up on a dirt road. So
I was. I literally grew up on a dirt road, and it is still dirt.
Yeah, exactly. Do you ever go back?
I go back. Now, you know, with two kids, it's hard to get back there as often as I'd like, but usually we go up there about once a year, around July 4th.
Yeah, nice.
The summertime's nice. But yeah, I've still got lots of family and friends there, so.
Yeah, right now it's freezing and terrible.
Yeah, wintertime, you don't want to hang out up there.
Yeah. So you're in junior high, and somebody's like, yo, you got to check out, this is the new what album? Like, well, how do you get involved in it?
So, like, just to back up a couple years, my first concert I went to was Randy Travis, and it was when he like kind of blew up and got really big. It was at our county fair, the Crawford County Fair. It was 1987. My aunt and uncle took me to the show, and it was kind of the first I'd seen it was the first concert I went to, so it had a big impact, but it was really country music. And I actually liked it. So then once I got into seventh grade, that was kind of like when the whole like Garth Brooks thing got huge, like country music blew up. So it, all of a sudden it was like, there's some of this music I like, and it was becoming popular as well. So it wasn't as much of a fringe. It was like, okay to like it as well. But, you know, I got into it, started listening to the lyrics. So I'm listening to like Garth Brooks and newer artists, you know, in the 90s, like Red Akins and Wade Hayes, but also Cypress Hill.
Yeah, right.
It's just that,
yeah, because when you're young, you're not thinking genres. You're just this is just music.
And to be honest, and then the whole grunge thing was going on at the time. Pearl Jam, I remember buying 10 on cassette. But, you know, a lot of my friends were kind of in the same boat, just kind of listening to what was popular, I guess.
Were you kind of curious why these people weren't mixing, or was there sort of an awareness of just like that's pop music, that's grunge, that's country?
I was pretty aware, and I think even more so than it is now. I mean, if you look at kids' playlists,
because there are record stores.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, like,
and you know, it was, I wasn't that aware that, I mean, I was aware that there was a difference, but I liked all of it.
Sure. And then when did you start writing? Did you come back from that Randy Travis concert, and you're like, yeah, I can write that song, and I'm 12 years old, or something?
No, I started playing piano when I was like 4, and then guitar in first grade, and from that moment, I was writing songs. I didn't realize it at the time, like, it was more like, I guess, like what we would call like a chorus. It was just like, here's a chorus, and then as I got junior high, I would write some that were a little more inappropriate, you know, fun, try to show off for your friends and make your parents sweat. But I always just made up songs. And
when was the first time you recorded a song?
Let's see. Okay, this is when I was in high school. I mean, I always would record on my boombox or whatever. But when I was in high school, my mom, who was a nurse, knew a guy at the hospital she worked at who was a maintenance guy, and he had some recording gear.
Sick.
It was like he had a proper, well, not proper, I guess. Yeah, a proper cassette recording studio in his basement. And she was like, hey, I'll give you $50 if Luke can come over and record some songs he wrote. So I went over there, and I had written some awful songs that I hope never resurface. I've still write a lot of awful songs, but
But now I feel like I should be a journalist and find this guy and get these recordings.
I won't give you names. but it was just really like, it was when I was in high school, and I would go over there and write and record, and then he would finish it out, like put like a fake bass on it and some fake drums, and I thought, man, this, because it sounded clean, you know, like this is really good, but they didn't have auto-tune.
Right. Right. So when did you get to, did you buy a Tascam thing? Like, were you, where it's, was there a point where you're like, oh, you know what? I can record this. If that wasn't that hard and I'm going to go and.
Yeah. You know, I still just saw myself as such a songwriter. Like anything to do with the studio was almost kind of intimidating. So I would, was literally just boombox recording. And I, when
this
I was
all in high school.
Yeah. And when I got into college, a roommate of mine had one of the Tascam 4-tracks and he would go home on the weekends and he would let me use it. And so then I kind of started getting into recording a little bit, but it was very amateur hour. And I didn't really get into recording myself or doing all that until a couple years after I had a publishing deal. I was just like, I'm just a writer, my guitar, my notebook, that's all I need.
Can you sing? You don't have to sing right now, literally. But yeah. Do you have the actual first songs like in your head? Do you remember them?
Unfortunately, yes.
What's kinda. The first song called?
Well, there's one I wrote in fifth grade called "The Thing Out of the Zipper."
The Thing Out of the Zipper.
Yeah. So you can imagine what that is. Awesome. I hope my parents listen to this. Right. My sisters will get a kick out of that too.
Right. So hey, would you just walk around the house singing?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I had a Casio keyboard, one of those that, you know, had the pre-programmed beats in it. Yeah. And you could, yeah. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, you can pick pop rock or, you know bossa nova. But I literally would, you could record in, you know, a sequence, whatever you wanted. So I'd play like chords on a really bad synth sounding thing, GCD to a beat. And let that loop, and then I would go.
You were like,
my guitar, play it, and sing.
You were
along
Ed Sheeran
to
thing
out.
Of,
yeah, I mean, yeah, he's got nothing on this.
On young Luke Laird, and
right. So I would literally, gosh, just play this awful. God, I'm sweating thinking about it, but it was, you know, it was fun. I just was so passionate about music.
How does it go?
The thing out of the, I can't.
Almost. Okay, so you go and you graduate high school in Pennsylvania and you go to Middle Tennessee State.
Yes.
And did you study music?
They have a music business program there, and I just knew that I had visited Nashville between the summer between my sophomore and junior year.
High school?
Yeah. Okay. We went on a family vacation, and that was the first time, I mean, it sounds so cliche, but I saw a show at the Bluebird Cafe and saw these writers. It was the first time I saw like real songwriters playing songs that they had written, and I knew these songs, and I was just fascinated. I was like, wow,
you've been doing. You just didn't even realize you were doing it.
And it put the thought in my head, like, wow, this is their job. Like, this is what I want to do. And so my parents were always very supportive, but like I said, they didn't do any music. So they, of course, wanted me to go to college, and my mom found out about MTSU having a recording industry program. So that was the only school I applied to.
There couldn't be a bunch of recording
no,
industry
music
schools.
Business.
Yeah, there weren't a ton of those at the time. I mean, maybe Belmont, maybe there.
In Belmont, you know, their location was great, but to be honest, the cost, the difference in cost, it just made sense to go to MTSU. Yeah. So, and it was great. I had a great experience. I did their music business program, but I was writing songs all through school. I would come up to Nashville and play open mic nights and do all that.
How old were you when you played the Bluebird the first time as a writer?
As like a real writer?
I don't know. Well, let's go with a real writer.
They do this thing where you can go in and put your name in a hat.
Yeah.
If you get drawn, you can go up. I did that thing, so it didn't matter how much your song sucked, you would get to play. I did that once. And that was
how old
like
were you
on
at that,
that
point?
That was like I was like 17.
Yeah. Like, did people there? Because there are some professional like people who are probably there watching.
I don't think so. I think that that's what happens, but most of those people don't come to the open mic night.
Right.
But it was, I thought it was good, but at the time you just think, well, if you can put a song together, man, it's pretty, you know, I don't know a lot of people that can put a song together. It's got a verse and a chorus. Mm-hmm. And so, but then they have this thing where, and I'm assuming they still do it, but where it's like an audition process. You go in, you play a verse and a chorus for a panel of one judge or whatever, somebody who's in the music business, and if it's good enough, then they call you back and say, okay, you're going to get to come perform three songs on this particular night. I did that. And that was like, right, I think right as I got into college, or I think it was like right when we first, when I first moved down there. But then after that, of course, now I've played it a zillion times since, but it's a huge deal. I still have like the letter, and back then it was before, I mean, email was around, but they would send you this letter. You passed the audition process. You get to come. Like,
it's a huge deal.
It was a huge deal for, you know, I thought it was just one of those little things that happened. You're like, huh, this might, it was like moving in a positive direction.
Did you think you were going to be an artist?
Mm-mm. I enjoyed like playing the writer's nights and that, but I think I figured out pretty quickly how much more I liked the creative process as opposed to being on the stage. And then once I was in the full-blown music scene, there's just, I also realized there's people who are way more talented and better singers and performers and that than me. So I never really like went for it as an artist. And I've, you know, I've been fortunate enough to get to work with a lot of great artists and kind of find what my thing, how I can help, you know?
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that bothered me as I got older, was realizing that when you grow up not in Nashville or LA, mm-hmm. you kind of think that if you're a singer, they just push you towards, you should then be the one on stage.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually like a lot of careers that you can have being creative in not just music, but in all the art forms.
Right.
It doesn't mean you have to go and perform. And I was a good enough performer along the way to get record deals, but I didn't mean that I loved it.
Yeah.
I really loved the writing. I didn't realize though, that you could make a living at that. Even as I was getting record deals and going through the process, I didn't know that you could actually go and spend a career
being
a studio guy.
Well, yeah, and I think that happens a lot. You know, as a young person, you think, oh, that would be awesome to get to go tour. And it would be, you know, and all that. But all of a sudden you realize, wow, first of all, there's a tiny percentage of people who make it as a big star. And just because someone has a record deal, like we all know that.
No.
Not that it doesn't mean anything, but it's there's so many things that have to fall into place for you to really make it. But as a songwriter, a producer, you can kind of go in and out of these different rooms and reinvent yourself. You know, if you write a song that tanks on the chart, that's not necessarily the end of your career. It could be the end of the artist's career.
Right.
But, and you know, you hope you're not the one who writes that, but, but it's, I don't know. It's cool to kind of be behind the scenes. And
yeah, there's no doubt I've released songs, or artists have released songs of mine that didn't go as well as the label had hoped. And I don't know what happened to the artist.
I know.
You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, the other thing is also as a, I can't think of another time or another, you have to be Adele or Ed Sheeran mm-hmm. or, you know, Bieber to compete with the writer. Well, that's in pop, but to compete with the writers who have 3-4 songs in the top 40 at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, you can actually have that and you can't do that as a writer, even if you're featured on things.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean,
but as a writer, you can be, you know. And I know we'll get to that, but I know you've had those months where it's probably like every song for a half hour of songs you wrote. But when you're in college, you start working for Brooks and Dunn's mm-hmm. tour manager.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So when you're on the road with them, well, first of all, how did you get that gig? And then when you were on the road, were you writing or were you trying to like slip people demos? Like, did you know what you were doing yet?
I mean, I was writing, yes, but I was very careful about, you know, trying to angle my way into. The thing about those guys were great to work for. And I had actually met Ronnie Dunn through his daughter who I was in college with. And we actually dated for a while, but that's,
right.
You know, and she was awesome. And he was just like, when I was getting ready to graduate school, he said, do you have a job yet? You know? And I was like, no. And he knew that I wanted to be a songwriter, but obviously I hadn't been offered a publishing deal. And so he said, why don't you come out on the road with us? And, So I went out there and didn't know anything about the road, but I learned so much, and they were great to learn from. I got to see how the whole live side of the music business, because that's another thing a lot of people don't know, that there's this whole other world within live music. I didn't know about it. And so I went out there, and we would be on the road from like Thursday to Sunday, and I would get up really early every morning and go find, like if we were at the venue, go find like a dressing room that wasn't being used and write songs. So then when I got off the road, I could go into publishers back on Music Row and play them new songs.
Did you ever play them songs, though? Even not the slipping? He knew you wanted to do
no,
it.
No, I really didn't.
You were just professional. About, yeah. You knew already at the time how to be professional.
Yeah. I kind of figured out, like, if you... That's the thing, you know, that if a couple people told me, and I still believe this is true in Nashville. Not that you don't want to hustle and try to make it happen, but... In Nashville, it is still such a songwriter town. There are these places that do open mic writer nights. If you are really talented and have really good songs, people find out. It's right. Like a small enough town. So I just knew if I kept working hard and I had made just enough connections, like to get in front of people who are actually in the scene to, you know, kind of give me good feedback, and I knew I was on the right track. And then I also told those guys working for them, if I did get offered a publishing deal, then I was going to not be working for them anymore. And they were totally cool with that. And so I just used it as a great like learning experience. And, you know, it was a great job to have.
So you get back and when is, that's like early 2000s.
Yeah,
right?
That was in like 2001 and 2002.
Right. And then you get a publishing deal pretty quick after that, right?
Well, the first time I played for a publisher, first of all, there was a writer in Nashville who I knew. He was from my hometown. I didn't actually know him then, but my mom and dad did, and we got introduced. And his name's Bill Luther. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, he actually had a significant amount of big hits. Tim McGraw, Kenny Chesney, all these people. He encouraged me because I'd played him a few songs and he thought they were good enough to at least get a shot at a publishing deal. So he introduced me to who would eventually become my first publisher, and that was Chris Oglesby at BMG. So the first time I played for Chris was probably like during my junior year of college. I didn't get offered a publishing deal until I was a year out of school. So
right.
Anytime I had new songs, I'd go in and play for him. He introduced me to other great publishers in Nashville, a guy named Scott Gunner, Carla Wallace, who runs Big Yellow Dog, and these people were all encouraging. My songs just weren't good enough at the time to get offered.
Did you know
deal.
That? That or was it frustrating? Yeah,
it was a little frustrating, but there was enough encouragement that yeah. I was like, okay, I just need to keep working harder. And at this point, too, it was just all songs I was writing by myself.
Right.
So I didn't really start co-writing until I had a publishing deal.
Right. I mean, all you need as an artist is hope.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it just keeps you going. And I think everybody who has a point of struggling is just because somebody says along the way, like, hey, yo, man, just stick with it. You got, yeah. like, that's
a
pretty close song. It's like, you know, like, keep going. I mean, it's hard to find those people that are encouraging even when you're not great yet.
Yeah.
You know?
I've learned it is definitely a skill or a talent or a gift for people who really can recognize potential, who can see it before it's fully developed.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, we call them in Nashville song people, like people who just know good songs and know good talent in its rawest form and can see it becoming. And it's like an A&R yeah. person, you know.
And to see it before, we interviewed Mike Caron, and mm-hmm. He's one of those guys who always would find these hooks in the middle of Iowa.
Yeah.
And just, you know, he doesn't care if you're who you are as a writer. He'll just say, that's a hit chorus.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that chorus and make airplanes for B.O.B. out of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like the guys who just don't care at all.
Right.
You know, it's an incredible talent. Do you have
it
that?
It really is. I don't know.
I mean, like, can you hear somebody who's totally unsigned, un-everything, and say, yeah, that's that's enough talent that that supersedes everything.
I think so. I think you have to be able to hear those. Like, even if you hear a song that might not be a hit, but you can hear those things within the way a person writes that are just unique enough that, like, it's those things that kind of like, oh, that's, it's like catches your ear. It doesn't sound just like a carbon copy of what's on the radio.
Right.
And that's what's exciting. Like, or like, that's like hearing an artist who has a thing in their voice. You're like, what, you know, it kind of almost, you're like, is that, wait, what is that?
Yeah. It's weird.
Yeah. And that's what I feel like we're always looking for. And in writing songs, I try to do that too. Like, if you write something that's, I don't know, that just sounds like a hit, it's like, okay, cool. But like, what is that little thing that's unique that's going to make it stand out from all the other zillions of songs that get written every day?
Totally. You get your deal 2002. And then from what I can tell, I mean, between 2002, I know you had songs that came out in 2007, and there's one in between that I saw. But, like, you have a five-year span there. Yeah.
Oh, I literally had one cut, signed in 2002. Every year I'm praying to, you know, get picked up on my publishing deal. My first release was in 2005. It was an album cut on Leanne Womack. And then my first single wasn't until 2007.
What happens between that? I mean, are you getting another job to subsidize, or is the publishing deal enough that you can at least pay for a room somewhere, or what?
It was just enough.
Right.
You know, in deals, that's the other thing. Publishing deals are different everywhere. Like, I know in L.A. a lot it's like cut and release, right?
And what do you mean?
Well, like, are a lot of the deals in L.A., like, how does it work? Because in Nashville, the kind of almost the standard way is you get an advance,
right?
A draw up front, but it's like a yearly advance,
right?
With a song quota.
Yeah, right.
And so the option's up every year for the publisher to drop you, but at the end of the 3 or 4 year term, you can get out too, even if you haven't, you know.
Right. Yeah, we have an MDRC situation, right? Which is basically means that if you have to release X amount of songs per term, or you get.
And I mean, I'll straight up tell you, like, my first publishing deal was they offered me $12,000 for a year.
Right.
And I was just honest. I was like, well, I can't really live off that. I could have found a way, like, get another job, but if I'm going to do this, I want to do this full time. So I'll just keep the publishing and find a job and they're like, well, okay, we'll double it. I thought, $24,000, you know?
Yeah.
And I was living the dream for real, because I was getting paid to write songs.
Sure.
And it's like one of the most exciting days of my life, you know, getting offered a publishing deal. Like, wow, they think I'm good enough to
fund your
to pay me to do what I did in my bedroom as a kid. So.
Mm-hmm. I always think it's weird that in my 20s, when I'm really sort of struggling to get by, getting the publishing deals, that kind of thing to stay afloat, there was always some way that I was out partying, drinking, having fun, and eating food. But I don't know how I did, because I don't know how. Yeah. I didn't have enough money to pay rent.
Right.
But I was always having fun and still drinking, you know?
I did a lot of that too, and that's why I had to quit.
Yeah, you've been sober for a while, right?
Yes, since I was 27.
So is there a correspondence between quitting drinking and this?
Oh, absolutely. The year I stopped drinking, 2005, you know.
That's when you have your first cut, you were saying.
Yep. Yeah. But I think that just the focus was more there after that. I was having fun and like, but I never was thinking of, hey, what if this doesn't work out? You know, I need to get serious. And so after I stopped drinking, I just was more passionate about music. Like, I spent more time on it. And really.
Did somebody tell you, like, hey, man, you gotta stop drinking?
Well, I think after doing 48 hours in jail. That kind of, I said I wanted to write country songs. So.
Right. How did that happen? What did you do?
I had my second DUI.
All right.
So it was a real like wake up moment. And, yeah. And so I just thought, you know what? What am I doing here?
You just needed some credibility is the problem.
Yeah, I was trying to get that street cred.
Right, exactly.
So
in 2007,
mm-hmm.
Okay, so I said in the intro that you have 22 number one songs, and I'm pretty sure that that is as many number one singles as all of our previous guests combined. It's going to be hard to go through, so I'm going to do kind of like a speed through along with some other questions as we go.
It's fine.
I'm just doing some highlights.
Okay.
But first of all, when did you meet Hillary Lindsay? Because clearly, like, 2005, you guys write together.
Hillary and I, the first time we wrote was in 2004.
Who introduced you guys?
That same writer I told you about, Bill Luther.
Yeah. What are the odds that two people from your town end up becoming professional writers? How many people are from that town?
700 people.
So crazy.
So it's not good odds.
Yeah, right. It's nuts.
But,
so anyway, he introduces you to Hillary.
Yes,
Lindsay.
And we ended up writing the song that was on Leon Womack's album called Painless.
On that first, first writing.
On the first write. So that was... You know, we met and we hit it off, and then Hillary and I ended up writing a lot of songs, just the two of us. And then,
did she have cuts at that point?
Yes, she. I think she wrote. She had already had like a number one or a couple, because I still remember her. Like, she said her first number one when she was like 24, 25.
Yeah, but you're not producing out these records yet, cause I don't think, right?
Nope.
So you're just writing demos and sending in tapes.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Because, I mean, you guys end up going on this insane run.
Yeah. You know, Hillary's, you know, I got to write with Carrie Underwood because of her, and as well as Chris Oglesby, who was helping set up Carrie's calendar. But, you know, Carrie's first album was massive, like 7 or 8 million albums sold. So for me to get that opportunity on the second one, when I have zero hits, you know, first of all, I thank Carrie a lot because for taking a chance on me, but also like obviously Hillary, because, you know, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have been in that room.
But it was because of what you guys did in 2004.
Yeah, it was the songs we had written that, you know, get the attention.
Did she, So Small and Last Name are, you know, your first really big records.
Yeah.
And those are both with Hillary. Were they written? They were written then, you know, sometime before 2007, before people are working on the Carrie Underwood album.
Sure.
I assume, right?
Yeah, we probably wrote the. I mean, I guess I don't know if that was in 06.
But she then plays these records, and it's just sort of like, yeah, those are going to be huge. We want to cut those, and then all of a sudden you're part of the scene,
right? So after that with Carrie, then, you know, before the next record of. I had the opportunity to work with her again, and in the meantime, you know, it brings more opportunities too, because you're on a song that people actually know.
Right.
We can get you in a room with new artist or whatever.
Right. Does it change your writing process? Do you feel any pressure when all of a sudden you're like, okay, here's.
I felt more. Yeah. I still feel pressure, but not in a, I don't know. It's a more, I'm more confident now, but my confidence is more like, not the pressure that it's all on me. When I go into a room with an artist, like I know, like I've had enough success that it's like, okay, if this just goes terrible, I don't think my career is over, but I don't know. I feel like I'm always learning new things, and it's being confident to not have to do everything.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm going to skip through 2008. But 2009, you start writing with Natalie Hemby and mm-hmm. Barry Dean.
Yes.
Do you start thinking about Creative Nation at that point? No way.
2009. No, I don't think so. No.
Because you start writing with the people that you end up being part of,
right?
You know, your future.
I wasn't thinking about that. I was, first of all, I love both of them as people, but their songs, they're amazing songwriters.
Sure.
And so working with, when you get to work with like your best friends and you think they're like two of the best songwriters, it's so much fun.
Wait, so you were friends with them before you were writing, or... How does that happen?
Well, Barry and I first met going back to 2002. The publisher, Chris Oglesby, signed both of us at the same time, you know, really the same month. But Barry had had a whole other career in Kansas.
His story is awesome.
But we just met and we just really liked each other as people, but we didn't write for a couple years until, you know. I mean, just because you know other writers, it doesn't always mean you're supposed to work together. But I think we were both fans of what each other did, and so when we first wrote, we just hit it off, and it's so easy to work with him. And Natalie, I had heard a CD of some of her songs from her publisher at the time, and I was just like everyone else, I feel like that hears her for the first time just in immediately because her songs are so cool and quirky and
her performance.
Her voice is ridiculous. And she just has a delivery that's
even
she's
in demos.
Such an artist. Yeah.
Her demos are just out of control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I want to work with that person.
Totally. Did you know Beth yet? Beth Laird?
Yes. This is always kind of a funny story or a neat story, but we met that same month I had my first cut released in 2005. She got her first proper job in the music business as a receptionist at BMG. That's how we met. So I started kind of hanging out up there by the desk a little bit and, you know, hey, what are you doing, you know? And later that year we started dating and been going strong ever since, but she went on after that to have a few other jobs, working at Windswept Publishing and then eventually BMI.
When did you guys get married in there?
We got married in 2010. That was like a year before we started Creative Nation.
Right. Was that sort of that you guys are like, let's get married and take over the world? Was that like in your vows?
Not at all. I mean, I think...
I do start a publishing company.
We were just like, how can we... just continue to do what we want to do the way we want to do it.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
You know, fortunately, it was at a point in my career where I could sell a catalog, and we're like, let's take this money and bet on ourselves. And so she had been at BMI for 5 years, and we just thought this would be a good time to go out and start our own thing.
Was it scary to spend money?
I mean,
I like the idea of spending money on myself, but I'm terribly frightened to
it is
hire people.
Yeah, it is. It's a risk, but you know, we had a couple different offers from some other companies, and we just kind of had a real heart to heart one night, and we were both like, "Look, if these other big companies are willing to take a chance on us, why don't we just bet on ourselves?" You know, we can do it. I was like, if it fails, I don't think that. I mean, I don't think we'll be completely broke. Maybe, but
it'll take longer to get broke.
Yeah. And, so we just bet on ourselves, and we're still doing that every day.
Yeah. And it gets addicting once it starts to work.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's been just enough stuff going on, and we've had the opportunity to work with some other great songwriters, and we're just going to keep going.
Well, before we get to the start of Creative Nation, yeah. 2010, 2011, that's when you kind of start getting all the accolades. It's like the CMA Triple Play Award a couple times. And is that changing your motivation? Is that, you know, at that point, your motivation's just like, oh, I just want to get songs released still. You're not thinking, you know, I don't know what happens when you start, when you're consistently.
To like have hits?
Yeah, you're talking about not just like one hit every so often. You're talking about, you know, 5, 10 kind of hits.
Well,
you know,
it's weird because it just, in a way, it like felt like it took so long, but then it felt like it happened so fast. And, you know, I mean, I'd like to think some of that is that I've become a better writer than I used to be.
Of course.
And, you know, writing is like it's exercising a muscle. So there's things that we do as writers now that are almost second nature that back in the beginning, you know, weren't. And I always say, like, your radar, like maybe your hit radar is better the more you're in the game, and you have to be in it continually doing it to stay relevant and working with new people. And I think what's so important, one thing that people forget is just that your schedule, like how are you spending your time? And that's why it's great to have like a great publisher or manager, somebody who's really protecting how you spend your days, because there's only so many days in a week, and you know, you have to take when to take a chance on trying something new that, you know, maybe not be a sure thing, to also trying to work with, you know, the biggest people in the business at the time.
Well, that staying relevant thing is the when you're talking about how important it is to bet on yourself.
Yeah.
And it's like the hard part is when you're betting on that artist that where the floor is non-existent because they don't even exist yet.
Yeah.
You know, and you're talking that thing is what's scary, because it's really easy. You could probably work with the classics who are still doing albums. You could do a whole schedule with the greatest artists of all time who aren't really selling units anymore, but it just, it looks cool or feels cool, but you're like, man, I mean, how many, this sounds terrible, but it's almost like how many times can you visit that museum, you know, and you're like, you feel terrible about it because you're like, how am I turning down this gig?
Yeah.
I loved this artist, but if you only go for the artist with the really high floor, you know, you're like, you know, they're going to sell some units, but you know that they're not going to, like, it's not going to move the needle.
Right.
The thing that moves the needle is if you keep betting on yourself. And that's like, it's so hard.
It is. But for me, it's really hard, but it's the most exciting thing, like working with a new artist who no one's heard of, or, you know, I mean, like the outside world hasn't. Sure. And you just know, sitting in that room, I mean, a lot of different things have to fall into place, but, you know, this could be like the next big thing. And that's what's exciting. And that's why we write songs too. I feel like if we all wanted a for sure thing, we would not do this business for sure. And some days you're like, why am I doing this? But that's what keeps it so exciting, because literally you can wake up that day and like, there's the chance that we could write just a song that's going to change the world, or at least make people dance at the club.
Well, the club that we
never go to.
That we never go to. And it's weird though, because I think people probably assume, you know, when you've had 22 number one songs, they assume their 23rd is inevitable. And that's like, you got to be kidding me. Like, that 22nd one was really difficult. It was just as difficult, if not harder, than maybe the third one. You know, or whatever numbers they go. It's like, you don't know. There's no guarantee you're going to have another hit ever. And the assumption from the outside sort of perspective is that the hit writers, well, they get in the room, so then they can have the hit. Well, no, they don't. No label wants to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on your average song just because your name is on it, you know?
It's so true. I mean, there are no guarantees. And I had a writer say to me, somebody who I'm friends with, who's having a lot of success right now, a lot of hits, said to me, "What are you going to do like when they stop, like when they hit stop?" I'm like, "Well, that is going to happen."
Yeah.
And I know Hall of Fame songwriters that it's happened to, and it's going to happen to me. And to me, like I don't want that to happen, but I know it's inevitable. And so I really try to just enjoy the process. And I'm a competitive person, but I try to just really enjoy just wake up and what is in front of me that day, try to do the best, write the best song I can, and just really try to enjoy it. Cause that moment in a room, here's the thing, having a number one song is amazing. It feels good. And in Nashville, they really celebrate number one. I mean, it really is. We get, I feel almost too much praise, sometimes. But it's an exciting thing. But to me, there's nothing better than that feeling of when, first of all, there's nothing more terrifying than when you go into a room with somebody new and oh, I hope I don't suck. And I hope I can come up with something. But then there's nothing better than feeling that feeling of once you know you've got the idea going. And it's just it's such a great feeling. Even if the song's not done, it's you got the hook or something like that. You're oh man, we got this. And it's, you can't describe that part of the creative process. You just can't compare it to anything else.
It's the best. There's nothing that staring at a chart isn't going to make you happy.
Absolutely not.
I obviously only have one country hit of any sort.
Oh, yeah.
And they sent the billboard or whatever, the poster that they put outside the, Warner Chapel.
Yes.
And it's I have this 6-foot by 10-foot thing in a giant tube.
I love it.
And it's in my garage. And you're what do I do with this?
I mean, just put it on the house, I guess.
You just on the outside of a song from on the 3-4 years ago. Just be just in case you guys forgot.
That's the other thing. You have to, doing this, people forget really fast. No one knows how many number ones you have unless it's you or your wife. So that's the other thing. It comes and goes so fast. So you just have to enjoy the moment. And I don't know.
Well, legacy is really stupid. I always feel like the idea that if you ask kids now who Paul McCartney is and they don't know who Paul McCartney is, it's a lost cause whatever I do. If I'm concerned about them knowing me, that's not how that works.
I mean, the thing is, doing this or anything, the whole legacy thing. I mean, I just want to do good work, and I hope my legacy is that I was a good husband and a good dad. Because at the end of the day, you want to do well in your career, but no amount of number ones or hit songs or dollars is gonna fulfill that, because it's a fleeting thing. So just getting to be part of it is really the win,
Yeah, I mean, it's a drug in that sense. Because you're just gonna be chasing that adrenaline. Yeah. But let's go to 2012. So you get Songwriter of the Year.
That's BMI.
Which is pretty rad. You have Take a Back Road, which wins Song of the Year.
Yeah.
And then Pontoon Breaks Little Big Town.
Yeah.
Drinking My Hand. I guess that doesn't break Eric Church, but it's kind of one of his biggest.
Yeah, it was his first number one.
Oh, it's his first, so it does kind of break him.
Well, I mean, he's still big. Without that song, he'd still be who he
is. Right.
I can't fool myself here.
You Breaks Chris Young.
I don't know if it broke him, but it was a big hit.
The difference of being the guy who's writing the hit song again, for the established artist, versus this sort of puts you on the page you have the ability to break a number of artists.
I like the challenge of it. And here's the thing: you don't know what's going to work or not, but it's exciting when you get to be part of an artist. For this last year, a guy, John Party.
Yeah.
Getting to be part of his first number one song was exciting because I knew he had the ability to do it. But like you said, there's just no guarantees. I mean, I know a lot of just crazy talented people who've never had one number one song, and it's just not a given.
When you do Pontoon, that's with
Barry and Natalie.
Is that the beginning of creative? If that's after they're part of Creative Nation?
No, but that I kind of look at it like the beginning of Creative Nation, only because, like, first of all, Creative Nation doesn't own that song, but that was like the first song that Beth pitched, like once we were starting our own thing. And so it was just one of those, like, that whole timing was really cool. That song was taken off, and we were starting Creative Nation, and Barry was, you know, like the first writer we had. We ended up signing, and then Natalie was after that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's fun when you can work with your friends. And
yeah, it's so cool.
It really is.
And that song shows it. Like, you don't write that song if you don't like the people you're in the session with.
Oh, gosh, no.
There's no way you're writing those lyrics if you're like, I really want to get out of this room.
No.
And I can't wait for this to be over. Let's just say this is a good chorus and move on. Like,
yeah,
you can't
just
do that in pontoon. No. That thing is like... You guys are having...
Oh, man, we had a blast.
Yeah. You also write with Neo that year. That's your first release with, like... That's like your kind of... I guess you had some pop releases, but that's like an A-list...
That was one...
An A-list pop artist that you're now writing... Now you're starting to, like, cross over. Was that the goal?
Yeah, it was kind of... Well, I mean, I just want to work on music that I like, you know? And that was, like, one that I got to co-write and produce.
You had to co-write with Neo?
Yeah, it was just like, right, you know, I actually met him through Carrie Underwood.
Okay.
He had, I think, reached out to her camp about working together, and then she pulled me in on the write. So the three of us wrote a song that's never been released that I still really like. But then his manager
called. My guess is you could still release that, and that would still do very well. that's an amazing duo.
It's a cool song. But then his manager called and asked if I wanted to come to Miami to work with him. So I actually went down there as a producer.
Were they like, yo, play us some tracks?
Yeah. So it was like I think when I first met him, he thought I was just the producer. Because, you know, in that world, it's like your track guy or top line. But with what I do, it's kind of like...
You're a songwriter.
What do I need to do? You know, right. So like if I need to make the track, I'll do it. If you don't want my beats, I'll write.
Well, I like that when, you get it in the beginning of Pontoon. You get the idea that like here's like this quirky way to treat, you know, a mandolin, right? Is that what it's on the front of it?
Man, you know, that was actually played by Jed Hughes.
Okay.
I didn't come up with that dun, 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 but... I'll have to, after we do this, I should play you the demo,
because yeah.
It is so dirty and raw and simple.
I mean, we haven't done that many songs together, but the songs that we have been like,
yeah.
you're doing beatboxing and you're playing guitar and kind of roughing up like some sound like, it's not at all what you would think, you know, country producer in quotes
right.
would do to show off a song.
Well, the other thing is too, I found too, if you can make something unique, like a demo unique, that's what's going to catch an artist's ear. If it's just a straight up professional sounding, like, yes, it may sound like a hit, could be on the radio, but sometimes you want to do...
But it might sound stock. Because
yeah, exactly.
And
it's
also
what you're trying to do
dated.
Lyrically, you know yeah. what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I just try to have fun with it and just, I don't think about the technical aspect, if something's distorted, what, you know...
Right,
if
of course.
It just kept getting the feeling across.
It kind of needs to sound like when you're recording on
yeah.
a Tascam back
yes.
in college.
Yeah.
So that way someone's like, oh, yeah, that sounds
oh, yeah,
real.
That, yeah.
I mean, exactly. When you're going down to Miami, are you actually, you come prepared with some tracks?
I have a few, like, things started, but I also just am ready to start from scratch.
Yeah, and that's when you guys wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounds like something kind of
yeah, it's
personal.
Very, yeah, it was just... That was one of those songs that didn't need a lot of bells and whistles.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
In 2013, it looks like you actually started producing a bunch of records that you didn't write. Were you doing that before that? Like, seems
not
like
really. I just kind of fell into that for some reason.
I mean, it's strange because of the demos that you're doing before,
yeah.
you know, they're all these unique records, and then they become these unique masters because of it. And then all of a sudden,
yeah.
people are like, yo, you should do...
Yeah, and it's that's one of those tricky things, because, you know, I could easily go out and just try to seek out a lot of production gigs, but that's not what I moved to Nashville to do. I moved to be the creator and write the songs. And
yeah.
So it's a, I enjoy production a lot, and but at the same time, it's just, it's more like my idea of producing is like being in the room while we're writing it and kind of going from there.
Right. Of course.
As opposed to just taking a song. I've done it from someone and then, okay, go do your thing.
You released One of Those Nights, Downtown, Somebody's Heartbreak, Beat the Summer, Get Me Some of That. You have a bunch of other number one songs, and then you have Casey Musgraves and Shane McAnally.
Yeah, that was...
like, of all the songs that I just listed that were number ones, at that point, you kind of just have, like, a stable of, like, that's part of, like, life and your day job in a weird sort of way.
Yeah, sure.
And then you have something that you put... You actually are with an artist before it really happens. You executive produce it along with Shane, or Shane produces it with you, writes it with you.
Yeah, we both produced and wrote that. And Casey, too. I mean, it was really a group effort. I met Casey. Beth, actually, was working at BMI. And in all her time there, she came home, and she's meeting with new writers every day and only ever told me about two people. In 5 years, one was Casey Musgraves and one was Brett Eldridge. But Casey, she's like, this girl, Casey, I think you'd really like her. We put her on this show tonight over at The Basement, which is this club in Nashville, bar in Nashville. And so I went, and that was the first time I saw Casey, just her and her guitar, with some other writers as well. But I was just blown away by her songwriting, and as well as I liked her delivery and kind of almost how understated, but really talented. And so we met after that and just started writing songs together, doing demos. And then Casey and Shane and I started writing together.
Had you worked with Shane before that?
I'd only written like one song with him.
So this was just, we should do this project together.
It was Casey totally orchestrated it. She's like, she came to me and him separately and like, I want you guys to produce and work on my record. And she didn't have a record deal yet, but we were both such big fans. I was like, I'm honored, but if it's going to keep you from getting a deal, like if they want you to work with Tony Brown or something, I don't want to stop that, you know, because I just like writing songs. But
is that self-deprecation, or you really thought like, no, you know, I just want to write the songs, you know?
I was dead serious. I just wanted to do what was ever going to get her to the next level. And so I didn't want to hold that back because I liked the stuff we were doing. I wanted to make sure it was going to get heard.
I mean, but to get heard also, it's like, here's a woman releasing an album in an era of country that has like, you know, Carrie Underwood and Miranda Lambert, and that's about it. I mean, I know like, you know, obviously Lil Big Town and Lady Antebellum, and you know, there are some women who are on radio, but for the most part it's like two women and then it's a slew of dudes. Like, are you nervous at all? It's like, you know, no, man, this girl's just dope. Like let's just do it.
I literally was like, this music inspires me, and she's such a phenomenal songwriter that I knew it was unique. So I'm like, if it never does anything, I'll never regret spending time on this because I love it. And that's how I feel like with any new artist that I work with.
Right, of course. In 2014, you have Give Me Back My Hometown, which is one of my favorites. American Kids, huge record. And there's so many. Sunshine Whiskey, Mean to Me. I mean, you start winning all kinds of things that you didn't win before. I mean, it sort of brings you to even another level that probably you weren't expecting to exist. You win Best Country Album with Casey. You know, you get the Triple Play Award again, and another CMA Song of the Year. You get ACM winner for Album of the Year. You get all these things. You get the nominated for Songwriter of the Year. Song I Wish I Would Have Written Award, a bunch of things. I mean, like, at this point, you're now, like, starting a family during this time, right?
When was that?
I don't know, 2014?
Yeah, so our first son, Jake, was born in 2013.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, like, I guess all that was going on, but I don't feel differently as far as still kind of working at the same pace. Just things were happening, you know. It's weird because it's so nice once you actually make money doing this. You're like, oh, I can probably drag this out for a few more years.
Right, yeah.
But
that's a uniform feeling too, I think, right?
Yeah.
Because it's that thing of, you know, the faucet's going to turn off, that thing of, like, sure. You know that they're going to say, you know,
yeah,
sorry, bro, your songs are not really good anymore.
It's not, yeah.
How long can I do this before they figure me out?
Yeah, well, I know. I feel like I've been fooling people for years, but still, you know, getting to do it. And my approach is still the same as it's always been.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've picked up little things on the way, but it's the same.
In 2015, you're kind of part of the huge, like, Luke Bryan next level thing. I mean, as far as artists go, I don't know if there's a bigger artist in the last 10 years.
Right now, he's really, you know, at the top of the game in country music and, you know, sells out everything.
Yeah.
I had written some songs with him and, you know, fortunately had one on his last record and one on this record. It's, you know, I haven't had tons of Luke cuts, but I'm grateful for the ones I have.
Yeah, for sure. Talladega is massive.
Mm-hmm.
Man, there's so many records, dude. Gunna, T-shirt, speaking of Thomas Rhett and our friend Joe London over here sitting on the
Speaking bed. Of massive.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the John Party year, too. Mm-hmm. Head Over Boots.
Yes.
And 2017 starts with, you know, you already start with the Triple Play Award and the, you know, nominated for Songwriter of the Year again on the ECMs. What's next?
Man.
I mean, is it, obviously Creative Nation is continuing to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are releasing songs that are doing well on a regular basis, you know, and yeah. Natalie's now doing her solo music and
Lori
and
McKenna put out a record. You know,
we put out a record.
We're a record label now as well.
Yeah.
So come on, guys.
When did that happen? Honestly, how
the music business is now, there's just no limit on. It's like one of those times in the business where it's kind of scary, but it's also really exciting. So, like, if you do want to put a record out, you can do it. You know. Yeah. It doesn't just have to be a major label thing. So,
do you team up with people to do promotion?
Yeah, yes. And, you know, honestly, Beth, she really heads up all of that.
Yeah.
But like with Lori, she introduced Lori to Dave Cobb, and they hit it off. They made a record, and we were like, well, I guess we'll put it out. And so 30 Tigers does the distribution, and she got, you know, nominated for a Grammy this year. On that album. So it's like, oh, I guess we're doing this too.
Do you think, is it hard to run a business and do the music stuff at the same time or no? Because, well, Beth is doing a lot of it.
No, yeah. It's not for me, but
it's
a lot of work.
Is it hard to show up in a session and be creative, or maybe that's why you like doing sessions in the morning?
Yeah. I think that if I was without Beth, I would not have my own company like I do. Like we do.
Right.
Like I'm just better off in the studio or writing. Like I know where my strengths and my weaknesses are. And
yeah.
I have way more weaknesses than I do strengths.
When we've done country stuff, you know what's going on in the pop world. And when I mention country music and pop sessions, I tend to get blank stares, but I always show all of these country records. I'm like, yo, check out this lyric. This is insane.
Did you show Charlie the Florida Georgia Line?
Which one?
He referenced a song. It was actually a song Thomas Rhett wrote, Round Here.
Oh, no.
Because he was like, man, I love that line. And I just was like, what?
Yeah. I show Stripes all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Because you showed me that. Yeah. And I was like, oh, my God. Stripes being Brandon Clark's record.
I mean, that is Nashville at its finest, you know. And my thing is, I love all kinds of music. And there certain different songs are great for different reasons. You know, like in Nashville, you know, traditionally it's been so lyrically based that if you know, there's been some people, like, if a song isn't just like this amazingly brilliant, wrapped up in a bow lyric, people are like, oh, it's not a good song. Well, then why are people still singing it 20 years later? For
right.
me, I love the most elementary lyrical pop song to the most creative, well-written lyric country song. And just, you know, it depends on what kind of mood I'm in or different. I think it goes back to me loving, like, Michael Jackson. Like, there's still, like, nothing that feels better than that to me.
When you're in country sessions, are you bringing up pop records as references? Or is it, or is there, you know, is, or when you're in pop sessions, are you bringing up country records as references? Or are you able to sort of divide the difference and it's just sort of whatever song we write today is whatever song we write today?
Yeah, I mean,
like the people in the room will just write
probably
the song.
A little bit of both. I mean, yeah. It just depends. I mean, I'm always listening to new music, so. But I'm not necessarily good at, like, breaking down, okay, this song, the BPM is so-and-so, like, I don't know, I just try to write something good.
Right. Do you feel like...
I'm not as analytical about it.
You writing, because there aren't a lot of people who cross over in, mm-hmm. in the writer or artist world.
Yeah.
Why are you writing with Snoop Dogg? Like, obviously because Snoop's the shit, but, like,
yeah.
I know you did your session with him, and, like, I think that's probably your biggest achievement in life. Is
yeah,
that you
I mean, the song's never even been released, but it was, yeah, I love the music. I mean, it all comes back to, like, I just, if I like what the artist does, I'm gonna maybe try to work with them, or maybe not, but I appreciate so many different kinds of music, and if I like it and listen to it all the time when I'm driving around, why would I not try to work with someone like that?
Oh yeah, of course. It's just interesting. It's
yeah.
just like it's a unique position to be in, that you can get in the room with Neo and Snoop and
I don't know how, like, I'm believe me, I'm just as surprised, like, why would they want to work with me?
Right. So, well, the thing is, if they, and when they get to know you and they're like, oh yeah, no, this guy's not he actually is good at writing these kinds of records.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be very familiar with the music. Like, I don't just try to get on, like, if it's an artist who I genuinely just am not a huge fan of the music or whatever, even if it's the biggest artist in the world, I'm not going to go try to work with them just to hopefully get paid. But I just enjoy working music that I like.
Yeah.
Working on it. So.
All right. So I'm going to just name five things and you just tell me what's sort of the first. We don't have a name for the segment. I always say that.
I must have not got to this part when I listened. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. We kind of just started it.
So I just say, like, the first thing that comes to my head?
Yeah,
okay.
Eric Church.
Badass.
Natalie Hemby, Barry Dean, and Laurie McKenna. That's one.
One word?
That's one word. Oh, I don't know. That's one statement.
The best.
Yeah. Brandi Clark.
Unique.
Carrie Underwood.
Gosh, there's a lot of.
You can use more than one word.
The first big artist that believed in me, so I just think grateful.
Yeah. Ashley Gourley.
Unmatched. Guy has more number ones, I think, than anyone that's ever had in Nashville. He's got like 33. And
do you find it competitive with, you know, Rodney Clausen and Ashley?
Yeah,
I mean,
but
all you guys are friends. Like, I love how you guys co-write with each other. So it's not like you guys.
It is, but you know, positive. Like, that's what you're up against. And when you sit in a room with someone like Ashley or Rodney, this isn't by chance that these guys have done what they've done. They are phenomenal songwriters. And like, in Ashley, he could write three songs a day that are all hits.
It's so fast.
And the thing, you know, the thing that I most respect about Ashley is he is doing this at a pace that I've never seen, but he also, like, his family doesn't come second to that. Like, he is
right. An
amazing dad and father. I mean, I respect that more than anything, just to see someone who work at such a high level but still have their priorities straight. It's really hard to do. I don't think he sleeps, I'm pretty
right.
sure.
Right. No, I think that's the right focus. But to end, you know, you were the first person. So in 2012, we meet, and we were in Aspen at a writing camp.
Oh, that's right.
And you were like, at the time, I had had cuts with, I'd had a few cuts, mm-hmm. Maroon 5, Nicki Minaj and stuff, yeah. But I hadn't had any singles really. And, you know, it's those things of along the way, the people who say like, yeah, I'll spend a day with this person, you know? And at the time you had had, you know, probably 12 number one songs. So when, you know, to spend a day with you is really important because it was, that was the first time where I was like, oh, if those are the people writing country, because my wife loves country, my dad yeah. loves country, then I kind of want to learn this.
Yeah.
And I spent so much time going back and forth with Nashville, because mm-hmm. I was like, I like these people.
Yeah.
And I like this vibe. And these people are like our world-class songwriters. Mm-hmm. And I had no introduction before that. So, you know, the fact that you're able to jump back and forth and that you care to jump back and forth mm-hmm. and that both sides of the industry really want you to come back and forth mm-hmm. is like, it's a cool, you're a cool role model to writers, not just in Nashville, but in the pop world too. So I appreciate you doing this. And I think you're doing amazing work. I'm excited to see what happens with Maggie Chapman. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see what happens with the rest of your career and mm-hmm. Creative Nation. And congratulations and thank you.
Man, thank you. And congrats to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to Jeff Sparger, David Silverstein from Mega House Music, and Michael White. Here's a sneak peek of next week's And the Writer Is.
We'd done our show and we come off the show and it was just a crazy thing. And he walked back over to say, well done, great show. He'd watched the show and we're like, shit, this is just crazy. And I closed the door. And then I hear Hey Jude being played on acoustic guitar. So there's the acoustic version of Hey Jude. And I'm thinking, man, this is just coming through the speakers of the, you know, the venue. This is awesome. They're playing like an acoustic version of Hold the Fuck Up. And I opened the door and there's Paul McCartney sitting on the back of a golf cart. Getting ready to go to stage.
Right. Warming up.
Just warming up, and he's singing Hey Jude.
Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.